I'm Matt Godbolt.
And I'm Ben Rady.
And this is Two's Compliment, a programming podcast. Hey, Ben.
Hey, Matt.
How you doing?
Doing great.
One of these days, we're going to have to come up with a better way of starting these podcasts than that, but we just seem to have fallen into it and it works, so I guess why not stick with it?
Yeah, that's what we did on the very first one. It was like, all right, that's...
Absolutely, we just shot from the hip and it was like, I guess that's our intro then, but this is no good. I mean,
classic
with the exception
programmer
of...
move of like, why do you do it this way? Well, that's what we've already done.
Exactly, yeah, right. Why would we change that? We've always used three spaces and a tab as indent. Okay, all right.
Spaces and a tab?
I think I have probably triggered everybody now.
Oh my God.
You have no words for that, I know.
I'm just going through in my mind all the terrible things I would do.
I think I met someone once who mentioned that they had some kind of compromise space tab thing. It was a bit like that.
Compromise.
So like everyone was equally offended by that setup. Well, this is probably the quickest we've ever gone off any kind of script that we had.
Oh my goodness, it's worth it. Worth it. Compromising on three spaces and a tab.
It wasn't exactly that, but it was something to do with that. And I mean, yeah. Well, we've never really talked about spaces and tabs here, yeah. And I don't propose that we do now because, you know, we should leave some things to the reader's imagination.
Yeah, we'd have to do a two-parter on that one.
So instead, let's talk about VI or Emacs. No.
Right. Yeah.
No, enough.
Yeah.
So what we were going to talk about, in fact, what we are going to talk about today was our own particular unusual experiences with web development, particularly in the industry that we have found ourselves both in, and how we've learned web development and then how we've taken that on into other aspects. I mean, I certainly have, in terms of things like, Compiler Explorer has definitely learnt stuff. But it comes essentially from the trading industry and actually indirectly through the same person who taught us both.
Yes.
His particular flavor and brand of how to do web development. So should we talk a bit about... Let's talk about Joe.
Let's talk about Joe. He's a person worth talking about.
He is a person worth talking about. So I first started working with Joe many years ago when we worked together at Google. And then when he left, he's the guy who brought me into finance effectively. But did you meet him first when you were at the trading company we first worked together at?
Yes. Dr. W.
Dr. W, yeah. That was in jokes. No in jokes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Joe is one of those rare individuals who just gets stuff done. He's an ideas person and has an amazing ability to just crank out stuff so quickly in a really, really seemingly impossibly short amount of time. And that's awesome. And part of that comes down to the techniques that he uses. And one of those is how he hacks together. And I'm going to say hack, and hopefully he won't be offended if he ever listens to this, which I'm sure he won't. Hacks together websites. So what are your experiences with the Joe approach? Or what is your definition of Joe approach? Because we haven't really thought about what it quantified it and why it's important.
I think rather than trying to define it in sort of any like specific terms, I think at least for me it makes more sense to sort of talk about how I learned it and sort of the evolution. You know, and we talk about like learning from other people a lot on this podcast and sort of the way that you do things. And I have this memory of Joe giving a presentation, sort of like a Geek Lunch style presentation at this trading company, talking about how he was building, you know, trading apps and other tools in Chrome. And the approach that he was using was very different from anything that I'd seen before. All the web development that I'd seen before had been extremely framework heavy. So you would go and you would get some web development framework and you would try to, you know, build your application in that framework and do whatever the framework did. And, you know, oftentimes the framework would make promises about like, oh, well, this will now work across different browsers, so you won't have different problems in different browsers, which always turned out to be false. You had other problems in different browsers. It was just harder to figure out what they were because you had this framework there that was, you know, trying to do things for you and was maybe sometimes doing some things for you, but, you know, wasn't always doing everything for you. And so he sort of presented this thing, and it was like, you know, a very simple approach where it's like, actually, and this was like in 2011.
I was going to say, it's about a decade ago, isn't it?
Yeah. He's like, actually, if you just use Chrome and you don't worry about other browsers.
Which uniquely we were placed to be able to do, for what it's worth. Which is a blessing that most people don't have, but...
Right. I mean, this whole approach is very, I think, a little idiosyncratic to the industry that we work in, the fact that you can get away with this. But he's like, we're just going to use Chrome. We're going to tell everybody, like, hey, if you want to use these apps, you should use them in Chrome. Maybe even put a little check in the app and say, like, hey, you're not using Chrome. I'm not going to do anything for you until you install Chrome. But if you just use Chrome and you just use the APIs that Chrome gives you, which are all web standard APIs, because at that point, and certainly today, but at that point, the web standards had kind of grown up. They sort of gave you a lot of things that you needed. You didn't really need a bunch of extra stuff. It was sort of like it's all there in the browser. So if you just use that, and you use some like very simple techniques for like HTML templating and a few other things, like you can build web applications without anything else, and they work great, and they're extremely simple.
Right.
And the advantage that has, at least in the trading industry, is that, you know, if you're building like a, especially like a click trading application, I mean, this is also true for tools and other things, but especially in click trading, you know, hundreds of milliseconds matters a lot.
And just for those who don't know, click trading is for like a manual trade where a human is deciding to make trades. Obviously, you and I have worked in industries, parts of the industry where everything's completely automated, but a click trader is like the UI for somebody to place orders. And they're going to be human quick, which is not high frequency quick, but it's still, if you click and it takes 2 seconds to respond because of whatever,
right?
Then you're going to get a very awkward question asked of you.
Right.
Come the miss of not actually, not getting that trade done.
Yeah, yeah. Why do we miss this? Because this button didn't do anything. And then the other place where I think this matters a lot is in control systems, which I definitely did a lot as web apps. Which, again, was kind of novel at the time, like the fact that Joe was sort of presenting this and saying, like, hey, you can do this, to say, like, you know, oh, the button to stop the trading system is here.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, if you click that button and it doesn't work,
then
really, really, really bad things are going to happen.
Yes.
So you need to make sure that you understand, you know, basically the whole stack of like, okay, I click this button, this event fires, this bit of JavaScript runs, it sends a message up to this WebSocket to this other thing, which then turns off the trading system, right? So like, if you can't, you know, sort of lay your hands on every little bit of that and make sure that you understand it all, it's harder and maybe not even wise to use web apps to build these things. But that was the brilliance of Joe, is that he sort of saw that you could do this and showed people how to do it. And I learned how to do it and a bunch of people that I worked with how to do it. And to this day, I still know a lot of people that are there and build apps this way and use them this way. But it is a little bit of an idiosyncratic method because you're not using, you know, you might use some sort of light libraries like jQuery.
Yeah, right? Well, I mean, even jQuery, I think, is mostly out of my canon as well. And I've mostly dropped out now. I don't need it. There are a couple of things I occasionally go, oh, I wish I had jQuery for this, but I just can't be bothered to bring it in. And, you know, when your web page is an HTML file, which is all of like a dozen lines, and then a single JavaScript file that has no external dependencies, that's kind of a nice place to be for a lot of like little systems that you're running, you know, and you can do quite a lot with that. You know, tables can be made to work, buttons, update, status bars, things like that. And effectively, you're using the way that I think of it is I'm using the web browser as purely a simplified canvas for my application to sort of render to. And most of the time it's not in like an actual canvas sense, right? But like there's about half dozen buttons that I need to be able to update the text on. And for that, I don't need React. And I don't need these other things. Now, occasionally you do find yourself going down the path where you're like, well, if I edit the value in this text box and hit enter, and meanwhile, someone else is editing the same text box, how do we deal with this kind of like state thing, if there's a server, all those kind of issues. And you know that frameworks do sometimes have solutions for you along those way, but you still have to think about them. So I don't know if it is that much of a a saving grace there. And maybe I haven't been exposed to the right framework to be able to have that opinion, which is, but I think, you know, again, this is now going a bit wider than what we're talking about. Like, frameworks in general are kind of, can be an issue, because if they do what you want, that's amazing. But if they don't, you're in trouble and you're kind of stuck. And I'm not fond of that inversion of control thing, you know, where framework calls you, you know, in Soviet Russia. So, but so anyway, that aside, but the for me, sitting down with Joe, and Joe back in 10 years ago, we were just, jQuery would be the thing that we would do just to unify and make a whole bunch of stuff relatively straightforward. And, you know, especially CSS selector type stuff is really, really straightforward in jQuery. But then going, how am I going to write, how am I going to make this table populate with all these rows and columns and things? Because I don't really don't want to be doing it in code. And you mentioned HTML templating, which I think is another amazing like trick. Well, we'll have a single CSS tag that says template. And then we'll have the single piece of CSS that says anything that's template is display none. And now I can find that template and I can clone it and add it to its parent, which means now I get another row in my table. And then I can remove the template CSS tag from it. And now suddenly I have used the thing that I've written out in HTML with just the class template as a template. And I've got a new row of my table. And now I can just fill it in. I can find all of the things and find the, you know, the second thing that's marked in a particular way. And that's where I'm going to change the text to be whatever. And that was an eye-opener for me. It's like, oh, how simple and elegant it is to be able to, in almost one continuous line of JavaScript, just with continuation, like dot this, dot remove class, dot whatever, dot find this thing, and dot text new line. And you're like, oh, it instantly reacts, and I have a web app that's responding to me straight away. That's great. I love it.
Yeah, and one of my favorite parts about that is that it means that you're editing HTML in an HTML editor, right? You don't have this weird thing where you're like got HTML interleaved inside of JavaScript and like you got to have a very smart editor that knows it's like, oh no, this string is actually like an HTML snippet. And so when you open one, you know, element, it's going to automatically close on the end, right? Like it's like, no, this is just HTML. You can load it in pretty much any editor.
And if you just delete that template tag of it as well, you can actually load it up and without the JavaScript and see what a single row would look like. So you have got a little bit of the, like, this is what the placeholders would look like. So that works pretty well too. So yeah, that was an eye-opener for me. And the WebSockets you mentioned there, which is, I don't know how many folks have actually done anything with WebSockets, but like the other sort of take home for me was just using WebSockets for everything. Like you go to a web page, the web server's responsibilities are to give you the HTML, to give you the JavaScript, and the CSS maybe, and then sit there. And as soon as you connect back through WebSockets, it gets out the way, and now you're talking pretty much directly to your server, forgetting the fact that there's a web browser there at all. And now you're just exchanging messages with the web page directly, and that was, another eye-opener. All this RESTful stuff I'd done before, you know, in query parameters. Do I put it in the hash string or do I put it as a query param? Do I post or get or whatever? So all that goes out the window because once you've got your app, the app is loaded and now you're just doing client-server stuff like it was a TCP connection. And that's amazing. And one of the tricks that we used to do as well, I mean, this, again, is something you should never, ever, ever, ever do unless you are 100% in control of everything like we are when we're saying about this. But what I've seen done before and with Joe was like to have a with block that says I can't even remember how it works now in JavaScript. It's been so long since I've done this, but essentially we just evaled whatever the text was that came down the web socket. Right. So that meant that the server could do literally anything it wanted to. And if you wanted every sort of command in your RPC was just like literally calling a JavaScript function that you had previously arranged. But you could also send down things that were like alert and anything at all, which of course is terribly dangerous. You know, you should never let your server execute directly the code. But it meant that you didn't actually have to write a protocol document. That was it. So that's eye-opening as well. And it's really, really, really powerful to be able to do that kind of stuff. And in fact, I was so enamored of this approach that when we started, when I moved on to C++ trading systems, I ended up writing, there weren't many things that were around for WebSockets at that time for C++. Mm-hmm. And so I just wrote a web server that had WebSockets thing support and embedded it into all of our trading systems. And then very quickly it was like, no more are we kind of SSHing onto boxes and poking around with processes, right, or kill minus hup to sort of shut down the trading system or having text files, whatever. It's like, no, you just go to the web page and there's the big red button, exactly as you described. And right, then very, very quickly you're like, well, wouldn't it be cool if we could visualize exactly what the internal state of the trading system was? Right. And then quickly, yeah, it becomes this beautiful web page with all of these beautiful like CSS things that are going on and mm-hmm, GIFs that are lights that go red and yeah, it just felt like, oh, yeah, this is a natural way of extending my application. And it just all came out of like a WebSocket connection. There's nothing really mm-hmm, clever behind the back of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's CSOX, right?
Isn't that's that CSOX library? Yeah, which is a terrible yeah, name, but yeah.
No, that's a very clever name. I like that.
I don't know, it's not as clever as I thought, but yeah. CSOX is pretty good. I mean, there are plenty of other ones out there now that are better, that are more C++17 and 20 or whatever, but this one was made to work, and it's been running for about 12 years now. And in fact, somebody managed to port it to work on Windows the other day, which I was surprised, because wow, it's just a Linux thing that I wanted to just have work. So, say, relatively low overhead, yeah, good fun. Yeah. And yeah, the world is your oyster once you've got a web yep, server and JavaScript, general purpose programming language, on both sides or on one side.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, what about you? What about your experiences with this kind of stuff?
I mean, I did basically the same thing. The one thing that I sort of realized as I was learning this stuff from Joe, that again was a huge departure from anything that I'd seen, because I've done some web development stuff before starting, before working with Joe, but all of it was just super painful, and I just
CGI
I don't like it. I don't like anything about this, right? And all of the arguing about, which HTTP verb is the right one here. And
is this
all this
a put
nonsense
or a post?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But the two things that I, the two additional things that I kind of got out of that were, if you build web applications this way, they are extremely testable.
Oh.
Like, extremely testable.
Well.
Like, and I still have carried this on to this day, where it's like, when I'm building web applications, like, my standard for unit testing is maybe even a little higher than it is in server-side languages like, Java or Python or Ruby or Clojure or stuff like that.
So how does that work? How do you what makes this testable? I'm genuinely intrigued now, because I don't know.
it mostly gets back to that whole templating approach, right? And you can expand on this and you can add lots of cool things to it, but the fundamental of it is, when I want to show some content on a page, the way I'm going to do that is I'm going to have a function. And that function takes some amount of input, and it returns an HTML element. Uh-huh. And that HTML element is almost certainly a template that has been cloned and then populated with stuff. And that stuff could actually be data, or it could also be click handlers. But none of that matters, because if all I've got is a function that returns an element, then I can pass stuff into the function, get the element back, say like, hey, is the value of this field the string foo? Cool. What happens if I trigger a click event on this element over here? Does it change to bar? Yes. And now fundamentally all you're doing is testing a tree. It's just a tree data structure. That's all it is, right?
With some handlers associated with it, but yeah, it's just, so you actually use the DOM objects themselves as sort of like the conduit by which you can interrogate, yes, and say, did you do the right thing? And not did you do the right thing because of the state of the program change or anything, but did the tree contain the right information, and does it
exactly
have the right behavior when I and treat it effectively as the testable object? That's amazing. Yeah, I'd never thought
right
of doing that.
Yeah,
that's so cool.
And really it was like, Joe like did some stuff with this. Joe was never few people are as bananas about testing as I am, but it was never like his main thing, but I sort of saw what he was doing, and I was like, oh, I could write tests for this. This would be great. And this was going back all the way to 2011, 2012. We started working on the Monocle project and other things like that at DRW. We started writing tests this way. The team I was working with started writing tests this way, and I've kind of done it that way ever since. And it's just, it creates this really great seam, which I had done a lot of work when I was right out of school with Java and Swing. right? Mm-hmm. I was actually hired to be a QT developer, and like a month into it, they're like, oh, you're not going to do any C++ or QT. You're going to do Java Swing instead. I'm like, okay, I don't know. And I spent probably 2 or 3 years, a little more than that actually, building 2D graphics tools in Swing. So this was a lot of like 2D canvas stuff, but also just user interfaces, you know, buttons and forms and things like that. And all of that stuff, I mean, even back then I was like super test infected, and I always had a really hard time testing any of that stuff. And part of the problem was this sort of like fundamental issue that you have with testing UIs, which is there's no such thing as assert pretty. Right?
Yeah.
You have to look at it. As a human being, you have to look at it and be like, is this intuitive? Does this make sense? Mm-hmm. Does this communicate the ability of the software to a person who would use it, a normal human being, of which I am a reasonable approximation? Yeah, close enough, right? anytime you see an open source tool with a user interface in it, I guarantee you that user interface, like 9 times out of 10, maybe 8 times out of 10, is just going to be terrible. It's going to be absolutely terrible because it's designed by programmers.
Have you seen my website? Just saying. I mean, it's not the best from that point of view. It's utilitarian. That's what I tell myself.
User experience designed by people who at best are able to synthetically replicate human emotion. Right.
Right. Like it's... I barely passed the Turing test.
Yes, right, exactly. But the problem with testing is like you always have this thing of like, I have to look at it. I have to look at it to know that it's right.
Yeah.
And one of the great things that sort of came out of that experience, you know, building these web UIs and being able to build things this way, is I found a seam. I found a line between that was very clear that I could explain to people between the stuff that you could reasonably unit test and the stuff that you just had to verify as a human being.
Right.
And that is the stuff that's just the tree, the DOM, all completely testable. All the events that you can trigger on there, all the classes that are on there, everything is completely testable. It's just a tree data structure. That's it. You can test it. It's super simple. The place that you can't is the CSS. It's the styling.
How
so you have the tree.
And how it reacts in terms of like the browser's representation of it. Right.
Right, right, right.
But the semantic thing that says the input box, it's an input, and
yes.
I know it has two fields, and one of them has this tag, and one of them says other tag, and the content should be this and that.
Yep.
And then it's like the style, it's up to the styling to make them look how it's presentable to a user, but I'm sure that I put the right information there. And now I can kind of, the responsibilities of the program have finished and the responsibilities of the styling take over at the point where you hand over and just agree on class names or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it creates this sort of like very clear boundary between I'm writing code and I'm writing tests to manipulate the DOM versus I'm basically acting as a UX designer now,
mm-hmm.
and I am styling that DOM, and I am choosing colors, and I'm choosing fonts, and
if you're right, I suppose the thing here is this is like asserting, you know, if I get an error, if I send an error to this thing, does it look red? And if you're writing your test like that, you're doing it wrong because it shouldn't be that it looks red. It's that it has the style class associated with it.
Yes, it has the error it has the error class on it. And that's the only thing I'm asserting in the test. It
because
doesn't
you
have
don't
the
know
error
whether
class.
Or not. That, yeah, it's a bit like doing localization, actually, now I'm thinking about it. You know, like,
it
again,
is.
You want to put the semantics of what are important. Yeah. And the thing that comes afterwards is the presentation layer, which is, you know, what does it actually come out of as? Yeah.
Right.
No,
that's a really good, it's a great point. It's a little bit like localization. It's a lot like localization, actually. But that separation, being able to have that separation, was a game changer for me. And I've gotten more sophisticated with it over the years, you know, started using different, like you'll have classes on the DOM that are strictly for styling. Like, you know, you'll see this a lot now with a lot of CSS frameworks where it's like you get these
like prefixes
classes that are like MT5, right? Margin top 5.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
And, you know, stuff like that. And I like that stuff a lot, but like that is purely for styling and I'm putting that in the templates. I'm almost certainly not writing unit tests to assert that it's there. unless I've got something where it's like, oh yeah, when this event happens, you need to handle that event by adding some margin to this element. In which case I might write a test that says like, hey, after the, you know, blur event happens, does this element now have the MT5 class? Cool. Great.
But you should also never do that, please. Like if you're changing the styling when somebody loses focus, then I'm going to come around with a club.
Yeah,
I think I showed you a website the other day where it was like wantonly on mouse move would like make a whole bunch of stuff appear on the screen that moved everything away to the point where it was impossible to click one of the bugbear's over.
The input just like runs away from your cursor.
Yeah, exactly. It's like one of those things. Like, come here.
Oh my god. But that was sort of a natural evolution out of that. And it tied into the whole thing of like, you know, and a lot of things that I did at aforementioned company was building like these click trading apps. Like we built them for a couple of different trading desks there. And, you know, some of them are like actually, it's weird to say latency sensitive, but it's like, that's what it is. Like speed really matters. And obviously correctness also matters a ton because, you know, you're acting in
you're sending millions of dollars worth of market, of trades into the market. Yeah, you wouldn't want
to
do that.
So the combination of those two things like really led me to this place of building applications this way, testing applications this way, and having this like super clear separation between here's the styling, and honestly we're probably not going to change it that much. We're going to write the CSS, we're going to put a couple of classes in there for the things that we need, and we're going to mostly leave it alone. And then primarily what we're doing is just, you know, getting messages from WebSockets, sending messages to WebSockets, calling functions, creating elements, and putting them in the DOM.
Yeah.
And that's it.
No, that's cool. So one of the things that I always found difficult with the limited amount compared to what you're describing of testing I was doing in the front end, and anyone who's used Compiler Explorer knows that there's not much in the way of front end testing, despite some of my friend's helping very much on that. But like, how does one in general do testing when the only thing that can really give you a DOM that acts the way that, well, maybe you'll tell me this isn't, but my instinct is the only thing that will provide a DOM interface that is true to life is a web browser, which is not something that I can script or debug in the same way. It's a very heavyweight thing. Compared to, you know, like what I'm used to with like, yeah, here's an assertion. It's a framework that I just literally call assert on it. And it's like, you know, call square root of 144 is 12. End of story.
Yeah. Well,
how do you test it?
So lately what I've been doing, I mean, I can go back and give you the whole history of how I got here. But lately what I've been doing is I've been using just headless browsers, usually headless Chrome.
Got it.
And I run all of my tests in CI and on the command line, just with the headless Chrome. There's a particular tool that I've been using more in the last couple of years, which I actually like a lot, called Karma.
Okay.
And what
I
Karma
think that might
will
be
do,
what we're using. I might have to go check over and see.
I like Karma. It's good. I mean, it lets you run. You can run multiple headless browsers at once, so it's like, and it has the whole, you know, continuous testing model of like whenever you change your code, it'll automatically rerun your tests. And it can rerun in multiple browsers if you want. I'm still, you know, if I'm building internal apps, I'm still doing the thing of like, hey, use Chrome. you know, if you have multiple browsers you need to test against. Because, yeah, I'm with you. Like, I've never been satisfied. I've tried, this was more 5, 6, 7 years ago. I've tried the all, like, you know, the Node.js simulated DOM stuff and libraries and all that.
Or even, you know, having the web browser open and, like, just having to manually eyeball the green on that and, like, reload the page. And it's actually running in the browser, like, as a thing, and it sets up. And I've never felt satisfied with that because it's, like, unless some Unix process returns a non-zero exit value, like, I don't think that my tests are testing anything.
Yeah. And I mean, in fairness, what I used to do is I would set up some kind of live reload setup. So this live reload is actually a library, but it's also kind of a technique of like every time you change, you know, a bit of markup or JavaScript or whatever, whatever browsers you have open that are connected to that app automatically reload.
Reload, right. There's the hot reloading thing that...
Yeah, the sort of hot reloading thing. And I've done that for a long, long time. And when I would just run my tests in the browser, that was fine because I just bring the browser window up and I'd see the test results there. But in the last few years, I've the tools have gotten good enough to where I feel like you can just do it entirely on the command line right now, and it gives you what you want. And if something goes wrong, there's still a web server running there. So the headless browsers are connecting to it. You can just connect a regular web browser to it, and you can debug it, right? So if something weird happens, you just open up a browser, go to localhost 9876, and there's your test runner, and you can open up the console, and you can see what's wrong, and you can step through the code, and you can do all the things that you normally do.
Daft question. What exactly does the headless Chrome do? You know, what is it like you run headless Chrome and give it a web address, and then it returns when the web page calls exit? Or how does that work? Where does the output of it go, and how
yeah,
does it...
Yeah. So the Karma tool that I've been using recently, the way it works is it launches the headless browser for you,
right?
And it communicates with it, right? So it is serving up this like generated HTML file that has all of your tests and the, you know, testing framework and a bunch of other stuff in it to communicate. And then it just opens the headless browser and points it at that thing. And then, you know, executes your tests and then gathers the results. And then if you're running it in continuous mode, it just prints the results out to a terminal. And every time you change it, it reruns the test. If you're running it in batch mode, it just returns you that, you know, non-zero error code or zero error code that you want. Prints out the results of the tests as it's doing it, and you can run it in your, you know, I have a couple of projects right now where I'm running it in GitHub Actions, and it works great, right?
Nice.
So I'm a huge fan of that, and it's definitely it's been a long evolution, because, you know, back in 2012 when we were doing this, it was literally like, well, we're gonna write these tests and we're gonna just put them in the browser, and we're going to just reload the page every time we make a change, right?
Right. I remember we deployed like a test.html that you could go to. So we would deploy it and then go to test.html and make sure that the actual deployed system passed all the tests before we tell the traders, yeah, okay, you can use it, which is unsatisfying, you know, but necessary. Yeah. And I mean, obviously, there are things like, and now I'm blanking, WebDriver, Selenium, I think, are the two, they may be the same thing now. I know Simon Stewart, who also knows Joe, incidentally, through the strange sort of like set of people that we know are involved with that. And that was very much more, as I understand it, with like run a full web browser and then write tests in terms of interrogating the DOM kind of exogenously to say like, hey, there should be a thing somewhere on this entire page that says hello world, and if there isn't, then we didn't load the web page properly or things like that. Those kinds of assertions are what you could run. And I'm sure I remember having conversations about like snapshotting and doing like pixel level comparisons about like, well, it ought to look something like this, you know, give or take 20% of error, which immediately is like, well, that's a very brittle test that you've just designed for yourself. But also it is a way of locking in a very specific behavior if you require it, which seems a little bit too much for me, and obviously it's not what we've been talking about now. But
I think if you have a lot of money to spend on testing, and you have a system that's fairly mature and not changing that much, then those kinds of approaches can be effective. They can be better than not doing them. And you know, especially if you had no front end tests and you're trying to retrofit them, I think that's a situation.
If you cast your mind back, however many years it is that we've been going now, when we had Claire on the program and the golden tests, tests. That's what I always called
golden
them.
Image.
Sorry, what did you say?
I said golden image, but
yeah, golden image. 2D, that's right. Yeah. Now I can't. I can't remember the name of the term that she uses. And I can see you. The color of Ben's face has changed as he clearly alt-tabbed away. Acceptance tests. I remembered it without even looking. Yes. It just happened. Uh-huh. Anyway, sorry, Claire.
Approval testing.
Approvals. There you go. Approval. Even better. Approval sorry, testing. I got it wrong.
Yes.
So approvals tests, which are a great way of retrofitting. Tests into a system that has none at all, when you can just go to the far end and say, well, okay, if I feed this text file into my compiler, I should get this executable out at the end, and I'm just going to do a bitwise comparison. It's a great starting point for doing no harm. Similarly, presumably this kind of test where you say, okay, simulate an 800 by 600 image, render the screen, and then kind of go, it ought to look like this. That's a equivalent of an approval test, but probably just too brittle.
Yeah.
I want to talk back a bit about performance, because, you know, if you like testing, then it's in character for me to talk about performance. I remember at the time that we were first looking at integrating some of these Chrome-based trading apps, they were displacing some C-sharp applications, like thick clients that were going. And the concern was that with, you know, a couple of hundred, if not a couple of thousand stock tickers and all of the information about them, that there would be no way that the UI could keep up with the torrent of information that's coming down the line. If you're a trader and you're saying, what's the trading volume, and your little graphs, you can imagine little spark line type graphs, and then a huge giant monitor full of these things all being updated in real time, you might imagine that it wouldn't be fast enough to keep up. And amazingly, it was. I think that was the first surprise, is that Joe was like, actually, the Chrome people are pretty smart. And this was, again, a decade ago. They've done a really, really good job of only updating the parts of the screen that actually changed. And if you're not daft in the way you write your JavaScript, if you're not always looking things up with like complicated CSS queries, you know, your whatever internal representation you have is, you know, you've got your array or your map of stock ticker to some object, and that some object contains the actual DOM element references of like where the hell things are, then it's really quite quick to sort of update the text of them, or to manipulate a little canvas tag associated with them. And that was super, super surprising to us at the time. We did hit some level of limiting factors when we were doing live views of a particular stock ticker's market. So hundreds of thousands of orders that were being added and removed from the market, and a graphical representation of them. And one of the limitations was bypassed by using canvases directly, which was one thing, rather than having lots of DOM elements that you were manipulating. In this particular case, where they were very, very specialist objects, so it made sense to take the time to actually draw them and undraw them ourselves. But another thing was not using JSON comms between the server and the client, like literally having like, well, there's a one character which says, if either is this a new order, is it the change to an existing order, or is it a deletion of an order. It's like a one character in ASCII followed by a space followed by a couple of other space separated things, and like hard coding our parser to you do that was quite a win back then. But maybe nowadays evaling a JSON object is faster.
I actually did a test on this just about a year ago. And I found, I was thinking about this exact scenario where it's sort of like, you know, we were communicating using these custom protocols instead of JSON. I'm like, is this still worthwhile? And so I had like a 5-field message. And so I was like, I'm just going to take this 5-field message and I'm going to delimit it with some character. And I don't even remember what character I picked, probably colon or something like that. And I'm going to have an equivalent JSON message with 5 key value pairs. And I'm going to see what the performance difference is just splitting the string on colons versus parsing the whole message. And it was more than 10x. It was more than 10x faster in Chrome. And I was honestly surprised by that.
I'm still surprised now. I mean, despite bringing it up, I thought it may have, you know, come together by now. But
part of this may have been the way that I had these messages structured is just the nature. I forget exactly what I was doing, but there was something where it was like 4 like reasonably small messages or fields in the message, and then 1 big field at the end that was like a, you know, like a 1K field, you know?
Right.
And I did take advantage of a little bit of a trick to say, I know there's 5 fields here. I'm always going to put the big field at the end, and I'm going to only split up to the first 4 colons, so that after you found that last one, you can just assume the whole rest of it.
So you don't even have to escape colons or anything that were in that blob at the end or whatever. Yes.
It's just all in there. And so that was a little bit of a hack, but with that, it was like significantly faster to not use JSON, which was surprising to me.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, obviously JSON is the right, or something like it, is a very good choice almost all of the time, because it's self-describing at some level. Yep. It's human readable for some level, of some definition of human readable. And and certainly if you're in the unenviable task of having to bust out Wireshark and look at some kind of communications between a client and server to work out what the heck happened, you've got more of a hope of understanding it. But for things where you have a very specific client and server that just need to be very performant, it's still, I'm surprised, but maybe I shouldn't have
been. Well, and the dev tools just treat JSON so much nicer too. You know, you can go and you can look at those WebSocket messages going back and forth, and it'll like parse them for you and do all the nice things for you. The other performance thing that I got from Joe, and I don't know if this is still true, but it certainly was true back then, is just avoiding DOM layout and just using fixed positioning for everything.
Oh, interesting. Right?
Like if you, and I remember him talking about this, and I think it was with a ladder that he was building where he's just like, I just absolutely position these things on the screen in the places where I know they are. And I, you know, can verify in the profiler that it's never triggering a layout when I change things.
Got it. Cause
it's
that's an interesting
positioned
one.
And it never has to relay out. And that was a huge thing. I don't know. I don't know if that's still true, but like it was certainly true back then. And that was one of the sort of the little tricks that we use to make it, you know, as you say, you've got this giant monitor with all these different, you know, graphs and charts and, you know, position tables and things, and you just got to make sure that it can keep up.
Yeah. And we also experimented, although never came to any firm conclusions at the time, with using GL style things. You know, you've got WebGL that lets you do hardware accelerated things. So if you've got, and obviously that's, you might naturally think of that as being a 3D thing, and indeed, you know, that's a lot of fun, making a huge model spin around and be lit and everything, but you can use it for 2D operations as well, and it, that might fit the bill for certain things. We really have gone off of topic here. I don't know. Well, I can't even remember what the topic was. It was just like web development our strange way, I suppose. So that
category. Our strange model of web development that we both, think, learned from.
So let's sort of do let's recap where we are with this. Yeah. And that is, like, we both come from a luxurious position of being able to dictate which web browser people can use, right?
You're right.
We don't advocate the needless dependency on third-party libraries. jQuery might get in there, but probably not anymore. Maybe
not
underscore.
Even these days, no.
Maybe may come in there. Certainly, that's very few and far between that I would add libraries. And that's more to do with being able to explain what the system is doing. Obviously, once it hits Chrome, you can't explain what's going on in there. But then there are Chrome dev tools and things that do help you there. But if there's any amount of eventing frameworky things in between, then, you know, maybe that's fuddish on our part, but certainly we haven't.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's a little superstitious. It's a little fuddish, but at the same time, it's sort of like, if I don't add those things, there's this whole category of problems that I can guarantee I won't have.
Right.
Now, would I have had those problems if I had added it in?
And
I don't know.
Have you booked in different problems by having to reinvent wheels yourself? Maybe. But
maybe.
So anyway, so minimizing your dependencies, I think in the sort of pre-conversation before this, you said, unless it brings a 10x benefit, then you don't bring it in. That seems like a not unreasonable thing to say. Similarly with that performance kind of thing. You know, if it's 10x faster, then maybe it's worth doing it a different way if you need the performance rather than just sucking it up and using JSON or whatever. Testing the DOM, that was another thing we brought up. Using the DOM as the kind of unit of what functions return and mutate and that kind of stuff. That's sort of a weird way of developing web tools, but it works for us. I'd be interested in what other people think of this and whether they're horrified at the fact that we're not using React.js or Dollar Framework here or jQuery. I'm gonna sort of walk this back a little bit. I've had some very good success with Knockout as a framework, which is an extremely thin framework. It's not really a framework at all. That's like the least frameworky framework that I've had good success with. And certainly for slightly more complicated interactions and DOM manipulations where things, you've got sliders that need to update numbers and like in another field or vice versa, where there's sort of bidirectional communications between like widgets, then something like Knockout, it can be a good thing. I haven't used it for a long while. And Compiler Explorer is mostly handwritten for what it's worth. It's a similar deal, right? Oh, everything inside of it. We do use a third-party component called Golden Layout, which is like the windowing system. And it coincidentally was written by a bunch of folks who were at a trading company and open sourced. So, you know, if you need a big old window full of like sub-windows that can be moved and repositioned and scaled and whatnot, then, you know, it turns out that the trading industry apparently needs that more than most other industries.
Yeah. Yeah, you talking about Knockout had me thinking. I have used a, I don't know if it's a library or framework, depends on what word you want to use there, called Backbone.
Oh, yeah.
Specifically, we used it for data binding. So this is this problem that we were just talking about. Like, okay, you've got your template, right? You've just cloned your template. You're inside the function. You got your data as an argument to the function. You've got your template. Now what? And that goes two ways. One is you got to put the data into the template. And then you might also want to have what some people call two-way data binding, where it's like, okay, I put the data into the template, I put it on the screen, now someone's changed it, I got to pull it back out again.
Yeah.
Right? And you can do a lot of stuff yourself. You can do a lot of stuff with some very simple conventions, right?
Yes.
Like, I'm going to name the field this, and I'm going to use the same thing on the class, so I know, and I'm going to select it.
And I have my generic on change thing, right, that just connects the two together or whatever, yeah.
Yep, yep. So you can do it like that. But there are also libraries and tools and things that will do that for you, and Backbone was one that I remember using and remember not hating. So I don't know how much of an endorsement that was. But,
that's
very but we big. Definitely, yeah, right. But we definitely like recognize one of the downsides of this, you were just saying, like solving problems yourself that you maybe don't have to. Data binding is one of those problems where it's like, I'm going to put data into these DOM elements. I'm probably going to have to pull it back out again in other instances. Are you going to handcraft all of that? Are you going to have some simple mechanism for that? Or are you going to use the library for that?
Right. And especially when there are some stupidities in the DOM where sometimes it's a dot value on something and sometimes it's the dot text.
Yep.
And you're like, which one is it?
I don't know. Yep.
Oh, no. The number of times that I've mucked that up and ended up with like an empty string or a none
and
or something.
And like escaping and dealing with, I mean, certainly jQuery is capable of handling this stuff, but it's sort of like escaping things so that you don't get like JavaScript injection attacks.
Oh, do you see?
On purpose or otherwise, right?
Oh.
Like, definitely have some things where it's like, where is the text of this thing? It's like, oh, there's some square brace or there's some angle brackets in there. That's not going to show up. That thinks that's a tag.
So one of the internal tools that Joe was responsible for at DRW that we won't talk about what it is specifically, but it did have a way of naming some of the little tabs that you could put up. Mm-hmm. And rather unfortunately, because Joe rolled it all himself, it was totally exploitable. And and so I used to embed my JavaScript emulator running Sonic the Hedgehog in a little pane. And then you could bookmark links that would like reproduce them. And then I would send it out to the traders and say, have you seen this? So don't ever take that out. That's great.
Yeah. Cool.
In summary then, don't use a framework. Mm-hmm. Unless you have to use a framework, but you sometimes use a framework. But
well, I would say this. I based on my experience, and again, we have this sort of weird background and this weird experience doing this. But I don't feel particularly wrong in saying you should learn the web standards. Like they're there. They're always there. They're gonna be there for a really long time. And it never hurts. Like, if you think of yourself as a React developer, you think of yourself as somebody that maybe knows a lot of different frameworks and is a web developer, there's a lot of knowledge there that you have, and that's great. And you will definitely not diminish that at all by learning how the web standards work and learning how browsers work under, like, one layer below you. Because there's just so much gold there. There's so much great stuff there, and you basically get it for free. So you should know about it. You should at least be aware that it exists.
I am absolutely loving this. You've seen me grinning like a fool at you while you've been telling me this, because this is the argument I use, but is you substitute framework users with C++ or compiled language people and web standards with the assembly code.
Yep.
And we're making the same argument. It's like, you don't have to use it, but you should know it's there and have a working understanding of it so that you know how the tools that you use are built on the layers and layers and layers above. And I mean, it goes all the way down as well. You can keep going down. It's great. That's what makes this job so interesting and working in the fields.
There's always
that
another layer.
So every time you think you've hit the bottom, there's another layer.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yep.
All right, my friend. Well, until next time.
Until next time.
You've been listening to Two's Compliment, a programming podcast by Ben Rady and Matt Godbolt. Find the show transcript and notes at twoscompliment.org. Contact us on Twitter at @2CP. That's at @TWOSCP. Theme music by Inverse Phase. InverseFaze.com.